Shrink Wrap Radio number 772. Actor, activist, author, poet, and Buddhist teacher Peter Coyote sharing stories from his journey.
And now it's time for Dr. Dave and Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
Peter Coyote, my guest today, is an award-winning actor, author, director, screenwriter, and narrator who has worked with some of the world's most distinguished filmmakers. Among his many books is The Lone Ranger and Tonto Meet the Buddha, which we may be referring to in the interview. Now, here's the interview. Peter Coyote, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you very much, David.
Well, I'm thrilled to have you on the show. I've long been a fan of your work as an actor on film and TV, and recently as a narrator, especially in the Ken Burns series. And I actually read somewhere that you've done more than 200 you've narrated more than 200 documentaries, you know, including the Ken Burns series, which is recognizable around the world and has helped to, has only increased your recognition. And so I must admit, I'm really excited to have a celebrity such as yourself on the show, even though I know you have a mixed relationship to your celebrity, and we can get into that a bit. As I've reviewed with you, but I'll let the audience know, we have some things in common. I think I'm 1 year older than you are. We both came up in the 60s. We both surfed the many events from that time till now. We're both living here in Sonoma County, although our paths haven't directly crossed until now, although we have friends and contacts in common, et cetera, et cetera. But let's go back to the beginning. Where were you born?
I was born in Manhattan, October 10th, 1941. And I think my family moved before I was 4 months old to Englewood, New Jersey, which was an old millionaire's playground just on the other side of the Hudson. A lot of big old shaded oak trees and kind of a great place to grow up. Pretty safe. Lots of woods to explore, brooks and creeks, and a pretty diverse population. A lot of black people. A lot of celebrities, jazz people particularly. Blue Note Records, Rudy Van Gelder was a very famous engineer who did a lot of Blue Note jazz records. I was a big jazz fan.
Wow.
So I look back on Englewood with a lot of fondness, but I also split my time with the family's cattle ranch in the Delaware Water Gap of Pennsylvania.
Well, tell us a bit about your family, too, about your parents, because
sure.
I'm under the impression that maybe they were in the Hollywood scene or something. Tell us about your parents.
Couldn't be farther away.
Okay.
So my mother's parents were Jews from the Pale, the Polish-Russian border, who fled the pogroms and the Tsar's draft and came to the Bronx and bought a watermelon and cut it up into pieces and started selling the pieces until they could buy a wagon to buy multiple watermelons. And my grandfather wound up with a little 3-seat soda fountain. he had three children. He had my mother, her sister, and my uncle, Sonny. And that side of the family was very warm, very intellectual. My cousin, Irving Adler, my mother's cousin, Irving Adler, was the first man fired from the New York City school system for being a communist. And he sued them 28 years later and won 28 years back pay.
Wow.
His son, Stephen Adler, was awarded Einstein's chair for life at the Princeton Advanced Institute physicist.
Yeah.
A lot of psychiatrists, a lot of social workers, do-gooders, labor organizers. My father's mother were Sephardic Jews from Spain and North Africa. They were not the friendliest people. The Sephards tend to be kind of like Boston Brahmins. Their pedigree is so long and so carefully manicured that they tended to marry cousins a lot because they could be sure they were the right sort of people.
Yeah.
And so there's a kind of chain of genius and insanity that runs through my family.
Okay.
A couple people, bipolar, a cousin who's in jail for life for having murdered his girlfriend. He's schizophrenic and his medicine failed. And my father's father was an Uzbek, very powerful man, a strong man in a carnival, also a very fine artist, a classically trained artist. And he came to America to study with Jacob Lipschitz. And he couldn't make a living, so he began working for United Cigar Stores as a sign painter. And within about 10 years, he was a vice president, lost all his money in the Depression. And took a shot of whiskey, went out, got a job as a cab driver, and started a lamp factory at 50 with my aunt's husband. And he was out there in the street with baseball bats fighting off communist union organizers. So my family was volatile and smart and kind of dangerous. And it was much more fearful inside the house than I was afraid of anything outside the house.
Wow, but what a rich soup, what a rich broth you emerged out of.
It was. So my dad went to MIT when he was 15. At 18, he was a sparring partner for Philadelphia Jack O'Brien, who was a light heavyweight champion who would fight any weight. And he was a genius at mathematics. He could multiply, you know, five-digit numbers in his head. And he made a fortune on Wall Street. He actually predicted the Depression and got his boss to sell out, for which he was capitalized for his own business.
Wow.
And for a long time in his life, everything he touched turned into money. He was the president of a railroad, Hudson Manhattan Railroad. He was president of an oil company.
This is your father you're talking about.
My father, yeah.
Wow.
So
on the one side, dirt poor, and on the other side, insanely wealthy.
Well, not insanely wealthy, but millionaire status, but not billionaire status. And he also reckless enough that he lost it all. And he died probably $20 million below broke in 1967 dollars.
Oh, my goodness.
And his great love was cattle. And he imported these French Charolais cattle and basically dominated the breed. They were rendered illegal by the Angus and Hereford lobbies because they were so big and they were so beautiful. So my dad and his partner painted black spots on them and ran them across the Rio Grande as Holsteins. And he actually made more money from these cattle than he did from his Wall Street business.
Oh, my goodness. Oh,
and
my
he loved
goodness.
It. But he lost it all. Wall Street took it down the drain.
Oh, my goodness. Now, at what point did you begin to realize that you wanted to have a creative career? I don't know if it was acting or what it initially was, but somehow you felt drawn to.
You know, so one of the problems when you grow up with a father like that, who's celebrated and who's intemperate and who's very violent. In my home, it was better to be a thief than to be stupid. And I'm left-handed. I have a very different kind of brain than my dad had. And I was just incapable of doing, you remember word problems when you went to school and it'd be problem like the train leaves station A at 5 miles an hour going north and the other one leaves station B at 11 miles an hour going south. What's the conductor's name? That's the way they all seem to me. And so he just thought I was stupid. He called me shit for brains all the time.
Oh, wow.
And it just, I could see I was never going to make any money. I was never going to be successful that way. And I became a really voracious reader. And I think I wrote my first poem at 7 and it frightened him. He actually realized for the first time that my brain was completely different than his. Huh. And unfortunately, he thought his job was to toughen me up for the world. Yeah, I was a dreamy, nice kid. And he just beat the shit out of me and tortured me as a kid trying to make me tough. And it really kind of estranged us for a long time and cost me a lot of wasted years of heroin and hanging out with the Hell's Angels and trying to come to terms with violence and all that stuff. But in all other regards, other than as a parent, he was a great man. He sent more people to college that no one ever knew about, which we found out in his papers, his gardener, his chauffeur, his this, his that. And he was generous and he was very funny and very quick-witted. And I admired him.
What a mix.
But I just couldn't seem to get his attention.
Right. What a mix. Wow. That's the whole novel you've just given us right there. And a movie.
it's why I wrote two memoirs.
I can believe it. I mean, I'm seeing the series Succession in my mind. I don't know if
you bet.
Yeah,
you bet.
Yeah. So
it's funny because Brian Cox is a good friend. And I love watching him get this triumph. He's been out to my house and he's like a political guy and a wonderful actor.
Okay. So, So again, when do you begin to get involved with film?
Oh, not till I was 40.
So oh, really?
So I went to college, and I was part of the black turtleneck sweater camel cigarette crowd. We were all poets.
I wanted to be a beatnik, and I was a little late for the beatnik thing. But
I studied the beatniks, and I was determined to follow in their footsteps, and did.
Same here, black turtleneck sweater and a beard in college.
Yeah.
And the fraternity guy said, hey, if you want to rush a fraternity, you better get rid of that fuzz. And I was so angered by that, I totally rebelled. But back to your story.
Yeah, well, my school didn't have fraternities, so I was lucky. So I graduated. I went to San Francisco State to get a master's in creative writing. And when I got there, it was in 1964. And it was boring, actually. I'd come out to study with a poet that I liked, but it was boring, and the ferment was starting on the street a little bit. And I joined this radical street theater company called the San Francisco Mime Troupe, where they just gave me my head. And this was not white-faced mime, the kind of guys you see pretending there's a pane of glass in front of them or lifting an object that isn't there. This was mime like Charlie Chaplin, where he uses, you know, he'll stick two forks in potatoes and use them as dancing feet, where an umbrella could be a rifle or a shovel. And we spoke and we took these 16th century Italian Commedia dell'arte shows, which were like Punch and Judy shows with stock characters. And we used them to talk about militarism or capitalism. And we were very popular in San Francisco. We played out in the parks where the people were. And it was just terrific fun. And then from the mime troupe, I formed one of the founders of a group called the Diggers.
And the Diggers? Yeah.
The Diggers was a real foray into social action.
Yeah.
We were very angry because the press was full of the growing counterculture. Kids were running away and coming to San Francisco. San Francisco was capitalizing on tourists. There were tour buses running through the Haight-Ashbury like we were orangutans, and we would spray paint the windows shut. But the city was doing nothing to help any of these kids. There was no medicine. There was no food. There was no shelter. They had nothing. So the Diggers decided most of the social protest at that time was implicitly communist or socialist. Everybody was reading Mao's Little Red Book, and we were not that. We were artists, and we didn't want to have to do plays about heroic elevator operators. We wanted to be authentic, and we wanted to live in a world where we could be authentic. So we took on the challenge of imagining a future that we wanted to live in and then making it real by acting it out. So the first thing we did was decide we wanted free food. So we sent our women with babes in arms down to the farmers' markets, and the old Italian greengrocers would load them up with food, and we would cook for 600 people a day.
Wow.
And all we had to do to get the food was pass through a yellow 2x4 rectangle, which we assembled, and we called it the free frame of reference. And they stepped through it, and on the other side, we gave them a 1-inch by 1-inch square tied to a shoelace and invited them to look at the world through a free frame of reference and imagine that things were free. Then we built a free store. We got a storefront, and we began collecting furniture, clothing, tools, bicycles. We put everything in good repair, and it was free. And not only were the objects in the store free, but the roles were free. And we wanted to do a piece of theater about storeness that people wouldn't know was a play. So people would come in and they'd say, well, who's in charge here? We'd say, you are. And if they just looked at us stupid, there's no point in blaming the man or the pigs or the system. We offered you a gift. But if you said, well, oh, God, I hate the way this is laid out, let's move the clothing over here. So we would do that. And the store had really radicalized people. And the implicit meaning of the store was, the hidden question was, why do you want to get a job to be an employee, to be a consumer? We'll give you the shit for nothing. Now, what do you want to do with your life? So we had, we also had the blanks and the codes for how to make draft cards, and a lot of soldiers en route to Vietnam, sort of word got out, and they would come to the store, and with a little decorous questioning, Bobby from Chillicothe could leave his mark from Texas in clothes he picked up off the rack and disappear. And that was one kid we saved from being a murderer or being maimed and wounded.
Yeah.
And then we got doctors to come down on Wednesday night, med students, to do free medicine. And that was picked up by a guy named David Smith, who founded the free medical clinic. So we did that for a couple of years until we decided that, you know, it wasn't our highest aspiration in life to run a soup kitchen. So we moved out to the country. We began creating strings of communes up and down the coast of California. And we did that for a long time, but mostly we didn't own the land bases, and we either lost them or we had to move. And then children came along, and children required more order and more solidity and stability. And so a lot of parents began to move out and live alone. And, you know, you couldn't have Wino Eddie playing the tom-tom at 4 in the morning when mothers were getting up to feed the babies at 5. So even though the core of the Diggers had merged by then with other radical families, we broke up, but we have 108 people on an email chain, and we kick in money every month. We support about 15 of our people who got old and indigent. So when all of that came a cropper, my friend Gary Snyder won the Pulitzer Prize, and the governor appointed him to run a state arts council. And he invited me to join it. And the next year I was invited the chairman, and the arts council became a huge success, one of Jerry Brown's two big wins. And the budget rose from $1 to $18 million a year. We created all sorts of programs. And to do that, I had to learn how to talk to conservatives, to Republicans, to rural people, to all sorts of different people. And when that was coming, after I was there for 8 years, around my fifth year, I realized that I didn't have to stay in the counterculture anymore. And the idea of going into the movies came to me because I needed to make some money. I was on a a make work program for $600 a month called a CETA program, comprehensive education and training. And they was working as an artist, but my real work was on the Arts Council. So I started doing plays in San Francisco back to back for 2 years. Then I convinced an agent to take a gamble on me. I said, look, I've been living in the counterculture for 10 years and I got appointed to this state agency and you saw what I did there. I raised this budget. I do what I say I'm going to do. I'm going to do the movies. And I, to myself, I said, I'll try it for 5 years. And if it doesn't work, I can do something else. And I was systematic and I was lucky. And so I got my Screen Actors Guild card when I was 39.
Yeah, one of the things that runs, a thread that runs through your life, I think, is your sense of commitment. Maybe you got that from your dad or somewhere along the way if you say you're going to do something, you really go ahead and do it and kind of commit to doing it.
I think, you know, both my sister and I and probably my dad had ADD, you know, what today would be classified as ADD. So we had to organize ways to protect us against our own minds. And one of those, like even today, my poor cleaning ladies, you know, I insist that everything goes back in the same place because otherwise I'll be hunting for it for 2 days. So when I decide I'm going to do something, I have to throw everything into it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But okay. I also aged out quickly. In other words, most movie stars at 50 are now doing films with younger actors who were the next generation of stars. So I had about a 10-year run because I was baby-faced, and I did a lot of big movies and was really even better known in Europe. But at a certain point, the roles get less interesting, and you're just working to pay the mortgage and keep your kids in school. And so as soon as my kids were out of graduate school, debt-free, I said, I'm done with that, and threw myself into my writing full time.
Okay, before we leave your movie career behind, what films are you most proud of as you think back? Which ones are the high points for you?
For different reasons. E.T. was obviously a high point, even though my role was not very challenging or difficult, but it was interesting to be in such an enormous success. Yeah. Even though I was out of work for 11 months when that movie came out. I did a movie called A Man in Love in Europe, which put me on the cover of every magazine in Europe. I got a little taste for a while of being a real star. But both people who saw it in America thought it was a good movie, but no one saw it here. I did a movie called Cross Creek that I liked very much. I did a very silly, stupid sci-fi movie in which I played an idiot Western villain, which was great fun. You know, I've done 160 movies for television and film, and most of them I call either mortgage or tuition. But I've been lucky to do some good things. I did a four-part TV series called Echoes in the Darkness, a true story about a high school principal who was a serial killer. You know, they once asked Marcello Mastroianni about his acting career, and his answer was really perfect. He said, look, you know, in the Middle Ages, they wouldn't even bury actors. He said, we're not so far removed from the idiot that does handsprings through the town square. The miracle is that occasionally we get to do something magnificent. The rest of it is work, 14-hour days, and, you know, you're away from your home and family, and you're on somebody else's clock all day long.
I'm thinking right now of the tragedy that's just happened to Alec Baldwin.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine. You know, I've done a lot of films with guns, and there's always an armorer on the set, a professional, and he handles the gun. He shows you that it's empty when it gives it to you. If he has blanks, he says hot gun on the set, and everybody is out of the line of fire. So I don't know if they were doing this on the cheap and they didn't have an armorer, but what I read was an assistant director just gave Baldwin the gun and told him it was empty. But you couldn't give me a gun and tell me it was empty that I wouldn't open and check.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I go to the shooting range every weekend. I love my guns. I like to shoot. I'm a target. I gave up hunting when I became a Buddhist. But I never look. Every gun's loaded as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I was always taught that as well. Did you ever have any interaction with Alec Baldwin as an actor?
No, but I've met him. He's very brilliant. I mean, he's really, really brilliant. He seems to have a problem with his temper. But, you know, it's a tough life being an actor. People don't really understand that you're rejected 99% of the time. There's always somebody getting the job that you wish you could have gotten, and that they think we have much more choice than we do. What I tell people is, I would take the best of what was offered. If I had a month's money in the bank, I would turn down garbage. If I had less than a month's money in the bank, I would take whatever came in the door. And it's pretty much like that, unless you're one of the, you know, 12 superstars.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. 160 films, that's quite a career. And so, but you've shared that the real heart of your passion was writing. And
yes.
So let's talk about that a bit.
Okay. So I wrote screenplays. I've written 12 screenplays. And it's amazing because I'm a prize-winning author. I'm a really good writer. Not one of these screenplays has ever been done. And there's so many problems getting people to agree on the actors, getting the money raised. People want to give you notes about this and about that. But at a certain point, I got discouraged and I said, screw it. I'm going to write a book. You know, it's just me and the typewriter. So my first book was called Sleeping Where I Fall. It took me 10 years, and it was my book about describing and coming to terms with the radical anarchist left in the counterculture. So that came out in 1999. That's still in print. They're using it at Harvard and a lot, I think at Ann Arbor too, a lot of schools where they're doing serious 60s studies, because the 60s is my generation's World War II. When I was in school, we studied World War II, and now kids are studying the 60s.
Yeah.
And then in 2015, well, I guess in 2000, I started another book called The Rain Man's Third Cure. And it's about the pursuit of wisdom, because at a certain age, you understand you need more than just smarts to get by. And so it's a book about mentors and teachers. And that book came out in 2015. That also was nominated, made top five best creative nonfiction. And now I just had a book of poems come out last Sunday, and I have a book coming out about classes that I've been teaching around the country for 40 years, where I use improv and acting exercises and finally masks to give people an actual experience of liberation. I can chase your personality right out of you and teach you to find it in a mask, in a mirror. And for 10 minutes, you will not have any shyness or lack of self-confidence or double thinking or self-criticism. And I use that as a loss leader to say, if you want to have recourse to those feelings, you have to learn how to meditate and you have to understand Buddhist philosophy. So that book is going to be called, that book is called The Lone Ranger and Tonto Meet Buddha.
Yes.
And then I just finished the draft of a fifth book called Vernacular Zen, where I want to demystify Zen for American audiences and loosen the Japanese gift wrapping around the Buddha's real gift and explain that gift in vernacular English.
Yeah.
And so it's less foreign, less autocratic, less hierarchical. And that's what I love to do. And I write all the time.
Let's step back to, you mentioned you wrote a book about mentorship and you had, it sounds like a profound experience of mentorship, maybe more than one, but particularly with Gary Snyder. You were a bit younger than him, right?
Oh, yeah. Gary is 12 years older than I am. Gary's 92 today.
Okay.
So what happened is in the counterculture, I was doing a lot of heroin. I was doing a lot of drugs, a lot of LSD, just trying to find some sense of freedom and enjoyment. And when that all came a cropper, when that all ended, well, first of all, I'd met Gary during that period, and he was just one of the most impressive people I'd ever met. And what impressed me about him was that he wasn't unevenly developed. Most people you meet and they have one talent or one muscle, like a great bicep, that they work on that and they let the rest go to hell. And Gary, everything he did up to the same kind of standard. And so he was the first person that gave me an inkling of how a Buddhist life might look. So we remained friends, and we're friends today. But then after the 60s was over, I quit heroin, I quit drugs, and I began meditating at the San Francisco Zen Center in San Francisco. And I thought, this is what Gary did. He'd lived in a Buddhist temple for 10 years. This is what Philip Whalen did, who was another one of the beat poets, who became a Zen priest. And I thought I'd see what I could learn from it. And when I did, it threw me up against a whole bunch of personal shortcomings right away. It was really hard. I was extremely undisciplined. I was used to doing whatever I wanted, whenever I wanted to. I hated limits. I hated any kind of frustration.
Yeah.
And I probably would have quit, except I was too proud. There were people at Zen Center that I thought were real jerks. And if they could do it, by God, I was going to do it. And after a couple of years, I settled down and I settled into it. And I began to understand the need for wisdom, which is really different than being smart and really different than just being lovey-dovey. And so the book that I wrote is called The Rain Man's Third Cure. And it comes from a line in a Dylan song called Stuck Inside of Memphis, Mobile with the Memphis Blues Again.
Right.
And the verse he sings was, the rain man gave me two cures. And he said, jump right in. The one was Texas medicine and the other was railroad gin. And like a fool, I mixed them and they strangled up my mind. And now people just get uglier and I have no sense of time. So that verse was in my mind, and I thought, well, Texas medicine must be peyote. So I let that stand as a trope for the counterculture, the collective, the holistic, shorthand the world of love. And railroad gin struck me as the go juice of the robber barons. And I let that stand for the world of competition, striving for money, striving for wealth, striving for status, the world of power. And so when I was young, when I was the age I was when Dylan released that song, and he was the same age as I am, I thought those were the only two choices. And I thought the trick was to get the mix right. Like, love without power is flaccid and weak and ineffectual, and power without love is fascism. So I began reviewing the mentors and teachers in my life and considering them seriously. And so that book was a book about mentors and teachers, but it's framed in two Zen retreats 40 years apart.
Wow.
My first one, in which I was just like a car wreck, and then my second one, in which I had a real spiritual breakthrough, which led eventually to my being ordained as a priest and being transmitted as an independent teacher. So, you know, it's a little cheesy for an actor to write two memoirs, but the books are less about myself than they are about ideas and startling individuals that I wanted people to meet and what their effect on me was.
Did you encounter any therapy along this journey and ideally have it, well, any good or bad therapy experiences?
I did. When I started at Zen Center, I was, you know, 35, 36 years old. I knew that this was kind of my last shot. So I interviewed 6 therapists, and I found one that I really liked, that I actually would like to be like. And I started working with him. I got him to take me 3 times a day, pretty much on the cuff. I mean, 3 times a week. Sorry.
Okay.
Yeah. I didn't have much money. And I worked with him assiduously for 2 years, and he died. And I started over with someone else for another 2 years. And so by that time, I had been living in a very strict environment at Zen Center and meditating. And to me, there was a perfect meld between therapy and meditation. Meditation doesn't solve everything. And there are certain obdurate traumas and beliefs that it takes a skillful therapist to get out. And today, as a teacher, I often recommend that people see a therapist for certain problems that are difficult.
Great. Fascinating. So let's talk about your teaching now, the mask workshops that you do. I have some experience with masks myself. And for many years, I taught a course called Myth, Dream, and Symbol. And I would have I would do a kind of mini workshop, a weekend workshop, and have students make a mask, kind of a plaster mask, and then dialogue with it and act out with it and do shadow kinds of work with it. So, I had an experience. It was interesting the way the mask would release things in a person's personality that normally they wouldn't express. And even once, as a faculty person, we had a faculty party with colleagues, and somebody broke out masks. And the stuff that came out, it's like it may be a line from Jung or from Jungians in general, that which conceals also reveals.
Yeah, exactly right. Well, yeah. So what I did was I began teaching to the children of Zen Center. I began teaching acting.
Uh-huh.
And then some of the adults liked it. And what I began to notice was these people were particularly fearless about plunging into shadowy areas and dark stuff. And I remembered an experience that I had at the mime troupe where I put on the mask of this character, Pantalone, and I looked in the mirror and I was just taken away. And when I was this character, there was nothing I couldn't do. I mean, I was fearless. And I thought, wow. So I realized that actors' exercises and improvs would be useful, would be a safe way to stress people and push them up against the limits of themselves. I start every class by meditating. And then I say to people, I'm going to tell you something. I'm going to prove it to you, but I'm going to ask you to take it on faith for right now. And right now, I'm going to tell you that you don't exist in the way you think you do, that there's no little homunculus inside your head doing your seeing, hearing, thinking. And when you meditate, I challenge you to find yourself, to find where it is, to find the shape, to find the color. And when they come out and they can't do that, I say, so right, if I was a car salesman and I told you I had a car for you, but I couldn't remember the make, the model, the color, or where I parked it, you'd be a little suspicious. Well, I want to encourage that suspicion because from a Buddhist point of view, there is no fixed self. You're just an awareness. And what you call a self is a combination of everything you've ever been told about yourself, implied about yourself from the way people respond to you, thought about yourself. And at a certain point, it becomes reified into an object. And at that point, it becomes a warden and not an assistant. If the self wasn't vital, it would never have survived the crucible of evolution. So what I do is I do half a morning putting people through exercises where I make them change their posture. I put a red dot on their nose and make them walk around with their nose extended way out. I put it on their chest. I put it on their groin. I have all these exercises, and then I question them. Was that how did that feel? What did that bring up to mind? And they would tell me the feelings, and I'd say, catalog it, remember it. You can always call it up by doing that, because these people are actors. So at the end of 4 or 5 hours of that, I bring people up in threes, and I put, with their back to the class, I have these neutral masks they put on. They're quite neutral. And because they're neutral, the body and physiognomy of every person who puts them on changes them. A mask that looks snide and sarcastic on one person will look serene and, you know, spiritual in another. So I hold a mirror up in front of them, and I tell them to tip their heads, open their eyes, and they move, and all of a sudden something clicks. And I ask them their name, and they know their name, and they know everything about this character. It's like a holographic event.
Wow.
And the way I understand it is, when the mind's faced with this blankness of this mask, it goes through all its memory banks. It goes through everything it's known and seen and assembles a character. So I would have those characters interact with each other, interact with the students in the class. Then I would take them back. They'd take the mask off. They'd hold it on their belly so we could see the actor and the mask at the same time. Then they would switch masks, and they would find another character. And by the time they had done this three times and found three completely holistic, different characters for whom they knew the family history, for whom they were surprising, they had different speech, they had different senses of humor, they were really open to my assertion that there is no fixed self.
Yeah.
That the self is an accretion of data that we refer to a lot. It's a focus for the parts of our body, all of which have awareness. You know you have hands because your hands are aware. You know you have a stomach because your stomach is aware. And the mind is like a coordinator, but it's not like an impulse goes to the mind and gets translated. Oh, yeah, that's my left hand. We are what Buddhists call skandhas, bundles of form, feeling, impulse, sensation, and consciousness. And these classes are the best initiation I can give to people to have an experience of what selflessness might feel like, and to induce them to pursue it by meditating and studying Buddhism.
Is this something that's open to the public currently, or by special invitation?
What's well, the deal? So I've been doing master classes. What I'm hoping is that when this book comes out, people will contact me through the book. I can only do about 12 students at a time. And I've been thinking about doing it publicly, local, doing a class every couple of months just to see what happens. But right now I'm just putting the subject out there because I'm the only person that does this.
Yeah.
You know, you have to be both a Buddhist and an actor to really pull it off. Right. But the experience, people never get over it. And I'll tell you how we use it in this act, in this voiceover school. So usually in the morning, I do these exercises. And then in the afternoon, I go in the studio. And people are given scripts they've never seen before, and they read them. And the woman who runs this school, it's called Voice Tracks, is a very skilled professional. Her name's Samantha Paris. We have the same agent. And so she and I will listen to these kids read, and they're very good. They're very polished, but often well-rounded and half an inch in diameter. They're trying to be professional. They're copying characteristics they've heard in other voiceovers. So at a certain point, I'll say, listen, I want you to read this text in the voice of one of the characters you found this morning. And the thing just comes alive. Everybody sits up. It's the difference between chicken shit and chicken salad. It's musical. It's funny. It's catching the import of every important word effortlessly because they've moved themselves out of the way. Now, the voice may not be appropriate. You can't have Tony Soprano selling Rolls Royces. But once they've done it with their character, I can say, okay, read it again now that you know it. And all the changes and all the new information will come across. So what it is a phenomenal problem-solving mechanism. It's a device to get you out of the way And I don't care if you're doing scene study. I don't care if you're counseling somebody, what it is, you will learn a great deal by moving yourself out of the way. And that's the ultimate value of enlightenment, of meditating and getting a more objective view of who you are.
This voiceover training is really fascinating to me. So this people who are, I guess, mostly going to do it for commercials.
They do commercials. They do documentaries. They do video games. There's much more work there than you think. And this woman, Samantha Parris, is brilliant at getting these people jobs. And she runs this very, very good school.
I'm a big listener of audiobooks. I've got some visual challenges, so I really enjoy audiobooks. And sometimes it's read by the author, and often that's really good. And some of them are bringing in voice actors. The one I just finished now is called The Lincoln Highway by Amor Towles, and I highly recommend it to you. And the actors in that really bring it to life. So I'm just fascinated by that whole process.
It's hard. You know, I just finished, I'm in the process of reading my new book as a voice audiobook.
Yeah.
And I don't do them much anymore. I used to do them. I did The Horse Whisperer. I did Hatchet. I did bunches of them. But it takes forever, and they pay nothing. You know, I can make more money in an hour documentary than I can in 4 or 5 days of reading a big book.
Yeah.
So I do my own sometime, but I've done some for friends. I did Lawrence Ferlinghetti's biography because he asked me to, and that was a book without punctuation. Talk about playing jazz. Anyway, I love books. I love biographies in particular.
Do you have a poem that you could share with us of your own?
Yeah, I do. As a matter of fact, I got a whole book.
Yeah, right.
Let me see what would be appropriate here. Hold on.
Okay.
I'll start with, I'll read two. This is 50 years work, this book. And so there's poems when I was very young, and there's poems when I was not so young. So I'll read you one sort of about my family, about my childhood. It's called, Do We All Mourn? Do we all mourn the childhood steamed away like water on a skillet? Have I lost a favorite book? I can't remember the title, just the word Esmeralda. Ruth, mother of my childhood, slapping solitaire in the after-school afternoon, raising her lipsticked glass. In my bedroom closet, something lurked every night behind the glow-in-the-dark star door. I made Ruth shut and rattle the handle 3 times to prove it closed. My dreams of shrieking cartoon cats and dogs, cries floating through the dark house, pollen guiding mother to my bed, giant pale Luna moth with sour breath. Make mommy another, darling, the Cutty Sark. Roger scaled the backyard fence carrying a rope. Enlisting my sister tied me to the steel swing set, cinching the knot tight, whispering, I'm really on your side, runs off with Muffet and eats my lunch. Morris slams the black Bakelite phone against the desk, eyes flecked with bitterness and his need to hurt something. Kicks Tan, my retriever, in the stomach. What did she do? I shout and run. The old man passed out, Demerol, standing in the open door of the refrigerator, sweaty head slipping on the damp glass, potato salad and deli salmon ripped open, untouched. Leading him to bed, turning the hall corner to his room, his shadow suddenly looming. He throws his boxer's weight behind a punch, crushing the plaster and skeletal laugh, while I tug him to where he sleeps. Was I carefree in the back before dark days? I can't remember. What was that book? Memory's a room with drawn shades, light seeping around the edges, but too dark to read. Only the shine on Wendy's lips glows, beguiling constellations of freckles, breasts stretching her ruddy sweater, impulses gathering mass in my jeans, her mocking smile. Was my body ever my own? I can't even hide inside it. My father's gaze now includes me among his enemies. Did the monster get me? I want to read that book again. Where did the luminous robin go, once so vivid, on my emerald lawn?
Yeah, beautiful. So evocative.
Well, they're all pretty different. I mean, here's one. This is the monster that I can be. This is why the world is lucky I'm a Zen priest. This is called Two Conversations in Chicago. If these walls could talk, huh? She gurgles conspiratorially, maneuvering a pink suitcase between the stainless steel jaws of the elevator as they hiss closed. I'm trapped in the bad air of her soiled hair, sullen face, cheesy white plastic belt, and cheap shoes. I disguise a gasp as preparation to speak. These walls, you mean the Chicago thing? Capone? She cocks her head as if inquiring if I'm alive. What did you think I meant? And the rumble of our descent appears to emanate from her mouth as a growl. I couldn't say I wasn't thinking anything. I didn't say, why don't you get your teeth fixed or brush them? I nearly said, hey, I've been demoted by divorce of a woman I never cheated on to this shabby shithole hotel and the forced confinement of an 8-floor drop while my silence is being violated by a woman resembling a pork chop. I wanted to say, couldn't we just stand here quietly while I stare into the perfect, undistorted mirror of myself that is you?
Ooh. That's a ride. I'm realizing that we haven't discussed your romantic life, the entanglements, which I assume would be many, more than one marriage, and you have kids, right?
Yeah. So I was never married to my daughter's mother, who ran away. I have a 53-year-old daughter. Then I was married to the woman who introduced me to Zen practice. And we have a son together who's 36. And then I was married to another woman for, we were together for 19 years in all. I'll read you a poem that will describe all my marriages. It's not long at all, but it'll just save a lot of trouble. It's called Earth is a Woman, Sure. Earth is a woman, sure. Earth is a woman, sure, but most beautiful when rain-glistened ravens are tattooed on the gray cheeks of the sky and the wild geese cry Avalokiteshvara's pity for the passing world. To you, my friend, questioning my lifelong addiction to women in despair, I can only offer the mystery of myself. Who will follow high cheekbones, long legs of an axe murderess into an abattoir? I evade the point, I know, but can't speak clearly about the constant fog in my mother's eyes and what is required for me to remember her rare smiles. I find the earth most beautiful when it rains, inspiring the limping, wounded rabbit in my brambles to venture forth. Decades earlier in the fragrant barn loft, safe in the blanket my father clutches around us as if we'd survived a shipwreck. The drumming tin shelters us from the rain assaulting the roof, scents of mown grass, and the pear brandy my father rubs off his chin as if summoning his own forgetting of the rusty nails set in his flesh when he was my age. His love of rain is mine. His wife, my mother, pale as a lab rat, was stripped of her rain clothes after my younger sister was born. In this remembered yesterday, our lives were opposing lines of traffic, headlight blind on a two-lane bridge. My father soothes my forgetting with his own, the heaving flank of mountain, his chest, that crushes my mother and sometimes darkens and fills the doorway of my room with threat, now sighs like a far wind. High in the eaves, pigeons pace and gargle restlessly.
Do you have any, are any of your poetry books, audio books where you read them?
We're going to make this. This is my only poetry book. This is my first book, 50 Years of Poetry. It's my secret life. And they want to make an audio, they want to make an audio book of it. You know, I don't know. I've always loved women, really loved women, the way their minds were, the way they are. I always knew they were smarter than most men. And because I was not interested in athletics and because I'd had enough competition from my dad, most of my friends in my childhood and through my life have been women, all my intimate friends. Most of them not lovers, but more than enough. And, you know, lots of men love sex, but not all men love women. And when you do, women appreciate it and they respond to it and you get their best.
Yeah.
So I don't really want to talk about my relationships, but, you know, I was in the movies. I was a celebrity for a while, and women tend to throw themselves at you for whatever reason, to get next to power, or get next to the juice. But still, I remember all of them. Sure. And, you know, today my closest friends are still women. I don't know what to say about it, except that I feel blessed by that. That I always understood. Maybe it was because my mom was not recognized in our house, and I knew how smart she was, and I knew my dad badgered her and made fun of certain kind of inarticulate quality that she had, but she was very deep. And when I was young, I used to explain to him what she was trying to think. And at the time, I thought I was being helpful. But I can realize now it must have compounded the insult, because my dad would stop teasing her to listen to his son. So he would listen to his 12-year-old son, but not his wife. And she struggled a lot. She had a tough life.
Yeah. I would imagine that fatherhood was quite a Zen school for you, given all that you've come through.
Yeah, it was. You know, my children are 16 years apart. And the only skill I can claim as a father is that I loved my kids. For my daughter, who was around on communes, she was with me a lot of the time, which is a plus, but she was also in a lot of unstable and crazy town environments. Maybe it's no accident she's a PhD psychologist today. And my son struggled for a long time with my leaving the family when he was about six. Even though I was there, I was a half-time parent, week on, week off. I was always around unless I was working and supporting them. But it turned out that we've become very, very close. And I feel blessed by my kids, who at the best have forgiven me my mistakes and inadequacies.
Well, wow.
I wasn't a very good father. I didn't have a good model how to be a good father.
No, you know, obviously you didn't.
But I tried.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what a ride. I appreciate your sharing with us as much as you have here. And Peter Coyote, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thank you, David. It's been wonderful. You asked me good questions. Thanks.
I really love this opportunity to interview Peter Coyote. We're pretty much the same age, and although I spent my adult years in academia and he in a mix of activism and theater, we both were influenced by the bohemian generation that came before us, the Beats. We both wore black turtleneck sweaters, grew beards, and got an initial exposure to Zen Buddhism through them. I was caught up in the folk boom of the early 60s, learning to play the guitar and hanging out in coffee houses. Our conversation didn't go there, but I'm pretty sure that would have been part of his trajectory as well. In fact, these speculations caused me to do a search just now on Peter Coyote music. And up came the following from petercoyote.com. Quote, Coyote has always been passionately involved with music and during the 60s played and performed often. He has been writing songs for 40 years and describes it as a passionate hobby. During the 60s, he was fortunate to find himself in the company of some of the greatest artists of that era, Bob Dylan, Janis Joplin, and the Grateful Dead, who sponsored his trip to England with Ken Kesey to meet the Beatles. Close quote. So yes, an affection for the folk music of that time is another thing we have in common, though he clearly was able to move in much higher circles. I really liked what I experienced of Peter in our interview, and it's easy to think that if we were to hang out in other circumstances, we'd have a lot to share, laugh, and maybe cry about. We both suffered some degree of trauma in our early years, though he more than me, I think. We both had family touched by communism and had to come to terms with our Jewish bloodlines. And, of course, we both lived through the assassinations, the protest movements of then and now, the brief magic of the hippie period, and the subsequent disillusionment. We both were swept up in the drug culture, but again, he much more than me. Although he's mostly known for his work in film, I was surprised to learn that didn't happen until he was well into midlife. As he spoke about his film career, his mixed feelings were clear. In fact, his stand towards his celebrity in general is that it's, quotes, thin soup, spoken like the longtime Buddhist meditator that he is. Clearly, he's always delivered brilliantly at most everything he's undertaken, but sometimes with real passion and others to pay the bills. I appreciated the degree to which he was able to let down his hair in our conversation, sharing his regrets around not being there fully as a father or in all his romantic entanglements. I was touched by his sharing that his deepest friendships were with women. Like so many of us male creatures, he sought hard to win his father's love and approval and to learn to be a man's man. But underneath that is his longing for the mother. I'm glad I thought to ask him whether he had any psychotherapy along the way. It was clear that he felt Buddhism was key to his coming through to a sense of clarity in his life, yet he shared that two long-term experiences with wise therapists were equally essential to his growth. He's quick to recognize that some spiritual seekers really need therapy to get past their early traumas. In fact, even with all the work he's done on himself, he says he has difficulty accessing his early traumatic memories. I'm looking forward to Peter's book of poetry coming out. I hope there will be an audiobook version with him as the reader. Peter Coyote feels to me like a soul brother, actually an older soul brother given all that he's experienced. The mask work that he described is clearly profound, a powerful distillation of years of both acting and meditation. You can find out more about him and his mask work in his 2017 book, The Lone Ranger and Tonto Meet the Buddha, which I am pleased to recommend to you.
Hi, Dr. Dave. Charles Cogshill calling from St. Louis, Missouri. Longtime listener and fan. Just want to send out a thank you for the incredible service you provide to growing clinical excellence and to the general public, and want to highly recommend others like myself that have benefited from your wonderful informative interviews to stop what they're doing right now and go ahead and make that contribution, that pledge to you for, again, the excellent work that you do. Wishing you the best, and hope to donate many, many times more. Thanks and good luck.
Thank you, Charles, there in St. Louis, Missouri. I do appreciate your long support and encouragement to others to follow your fine example. You know, as I review the honor roll and putting together the latest interview, I'm so appreciative of all of you monthly donors. In fact, I'd like to read out the names of those monthly donors whose donations have just landed in the last several days. Terry Keller, Sorka McGrath, Ann Chandler, Clive Van Hilton, Jennifer Alexander, Trevor Ehrman, Neil Brown, Catherine Gibson, Jennifer Villegas, and Michael Murphy. And of course, thank you to all you other monthly supporters. Your regular donations mean so much to me personally and also help to support the regular expenses that the show incurs. So it's time to shrink wrap it up once again. Big thanks to Peter Coyote. What a privilege to interview such a broadly accomplished, multi-talented celebrity who has lived life with full intensity and given us all so many gifts. Next week, my return guest will be UK psychoanalyst and author Professor Brett Carr, who will be discussing one of his latest books, Freud's Pandemics, Surviving Global War, Spanish Flu, and the Nazis. So, until then, this is Dr. Dave reminding you to be kind to yourself and others.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.